Good evening. James McCanny here, going right into the show tonight. September 25th, 2008, and this past week, we passed the autumnal equinox, the day of the year when the daytime is equal to the nighttime, so to speak, 12 hours, and there are some small variations. It gets rather complicated in the real world of astronomy when we start talking about when is the exact moment, first moment of fall, the season that precedes winter, that comes after summer. And this same type of event happens in the spring, known as the vernal equinox. But anyway, it's when the day and the nighttime essentially are equal. So we just passed that this past week on the, actually it occurred on the 22nd of September this year. And that varies at, sometimes it's on the 21st, that's the official day for the changing of the season. But it can vary by almost as much as a day, because our calendar has equal days. We have a clock, which we've designated as 24 hours, which is the average amount of time in a day. But there's a few little quirks in our orbit, the orbit of Earth. It comes closer to the sun at certain points, and it's somewhat elliptical, in other words, and therefore some days noon according to the sun is not exactly noon according to the clock. But at any rate, those are some little nuances regarding if you take a basic astronomy course, then you would learn those little details. But for all practical purposes, it is when Earth has the same number of hours and minutes in the day as the nighttime. That's kind of an average. I want to make a couple announcements. By the way, the main science topic for tonight, actually I have three of them. I'll do a little bit of a review on weather modification and what does it take to modify weather systems. The second topic will be a kind of a review of the Big Bang and some of the nonsensical gee-whiz science that's floating around that you would see or read about in magazines that you would get on the newsstand today. And then number three, I'll be talking about electric trains, planes, and automobiles. Just a little bit of a review there. And in there, you noticed I said planes, meaning electric airplanes. What is the future of electricity driving airplanes? And actually, it's has quite a bright future. It turns out that it, of course, all depends on batteries. We have the motors. If you look at electric motors, you get far more power per pound out of an electric motor than you do out of a gasoline motor. But the issue is the battery, the containment of electrical energy, the storage of electrical energy, and how it, the weight related to that. But I'm quite impressed. A good example of electrical airplane technology is in little model airplanes. You can find these on the market today readily, and they fly for a very long time. Something that would not have taken place 10 or even 20 years ago or even 10 years ago. So at any rate, the third science topic for the night, electric trains, planes, and automobiles. Just a little bit of a review there, but concentrating on airplanes. So first of all, a few announcements. The seed program, the corn seed program, is all finished. Now, there are some people who are still getting some orders filled, and those people will get their seed orders Just wanted to let you know that, but the ordering mechanisms basically have been shut down. The purchase button and link from the web page, the secure web ordering page, has been removed. And so the seed program was a huge, huge success. And I've talked about that in past weeks. And I believe last week I still did a little, still the offer was still available. But basically it's been shut down. And I believe I accomplished what I set out to do. Then that was to distribute that corn seed as far and as wide as possible. And as I said, if you have ordered and have not received your corn yet, then don't worry. It will be, they're still shipping some, but that will be pretty much taken care of and cleaned up and all finished very shortly. There was an article this past week, which a number of people sent me, but the first time I got it was from a friend of mine. His name is Brad Walton. He's a talk show host with WCCO in Minneapolis. I've been a guest on his show many times. But was it Saturday night or Sunday morning, he got a hold of me and sent me this article that, of course, comes on the feed. This one came from Reuters. It said, Stardust evidence points to planet collision. Once again, I'll read this title that just came out this past weekend. Stardust evidence points to planet collision. So anyway, a couple of astronomers, from University of California, Los Angeles, otherwise known as UCLA, and also from Tennessee State University and California Institute of Technology in a joint effort, discovered a star, not our own, of course, but this is another star, with a dust cloud orbiting this star, they said, around 300 light years from Earth in the constellation Aries. Now, 300 light years is relatively close. That's relatively close by. I think our nearest stellar neighbor is around 4.5 light years. And we live kind of out in the boondocks of the galaxy, so to speak. We live in a very remote area of the Milky Way galaxy. And so there are not many stars that are within 300 light years. There's a few, kind of a handful, but this star that they saw 300 light years away is relatively close. That means that it would take light 300 years to travel that distance. But I wanted to just read a couple lines out of this article. And of course, keep in mind, there are people that have been saying for years that there's evidence in our own solar system that planets have collided. And, of course, one of those guys was a guy named Emanuel Velikovsky, and his book, Worlds in Collision, specifically related to Venus having a collisionary involvement with Earth. And, of course, I've talked before about how the Mayan calendar, of course, you hear all kinds of garbage these days about the Mayan calendar. The reality is the Mayan calendar has absolutely nothing to do with our sun or moon. The Aztecs were the first Mesoamerican culture to really use the sun and the moon to base their calendar on. And the reason for that is because of the great catastrophe that the Noah's flood event, whatever you want to call it, was caused by a large passing comet that eventually became the planet Venus. And my science work shows how specifically that happens, because comets are not dirty snowballs. They can become very large. Not all comets are big, and that's what has fooled astronomers. So anyway, I'm not going to go into that detail tonight, but the point is, of course, I have my science work was not developed to support Velikovsky. It was developed quite independent. In fact, it was developed before I even knew who Velikovsky was, back in the 1970s. And so then once I heard about Velikovsky, I said, gee, that sounds a lot like my scientific theories. And then it became obvious after reading Velikovsky that, in fact, there was a lot of truth to what that guy was saying. And, of course, he was highly ridiculed by the astronomical community for making any suggestion that Venus could somehow collide or have an encounter, a planetary encounter with Earth. So that's one event, and I typically don't mention names on the show. It's been promoting an idea that a couple planets could have collided and caused our asteroid belt. And, of course, there's no direct proof for that other than I should say no direct proof because nobody was around when the planets collided to give us a direct scientific observation. But at any rate, there's a person who has been stating that there's scientific remnant and evidence, so to speak, to suggest that maybe a couple planets collided in that region between Mars and Jupiter, and that could be the cause of many of the asteroids. And of course, I've also stated that many of those can be explained by capture. In other words, the Jupiter and the other planets, all the planets have the ability to capture objects, but Jupiter being the largest has the largest family of captured objects. And that region between Mars and Jupiter is just an area where there's no planet to sweep them out. So it's a collecting area. So Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, all the big planets could easily contribute to the objects in there whilst picking up some as moons. And, of course, comets, each one of those big, what we call planets, has a family of associated comets. All of them captured, or most likely captured. But at any rate, let's get back to this article that came out of Reuters this past weekend. Now, when I read this, I just about fell off my chair, because this article, written by these three astronomers, was published in Astrophysical Journal, a peer-reviewed, high-end astrophysics journal, and, of course, well-respected in the astrophysics astronomy community. So, lo and behold, all of a sudden, these people are saying the following, that large amounts of dust floating around this star they discovered, around 300 light-years from Earth, suggests that two Earth-like planets obliterated each other in a violent collision. Here are a couple quotes from the Reuters article. It is as if Earth and Venus collided with each other. Now, I made a posting on my webpage and I said, this is amazingly funny. Are these guys so cloistered that they don't know about Velikovsky and the ban on saying anything like this in the press? I read this and I just about fell off my chair, because this was published in Astrophysical Journal. Then it goes on to say, the astronomers have never seen anything like this before. Oh, gee. And I suppose they're making this claim that they've never heard about anything like this before. Well, anyway, let me read on. Astronomers have never seen anything like this before. Apparently, major catastrophic collisions can take place in a fully mature planetary system. Can you believe these guys are saying this? I mean, where have these people been? Have they been cloistered in their little ivory tower so long that they have no clue? They've never heard about Planet X. They've never heard about Velikovsky or the other people who have talked about this type of event. Now it says, if any life was present on either planet, the massive collision would have wiped out everything in a matter of minutes, the ultimate extinction event. Once again, this is being published in Astrophysical Journal. And then the very last statement just puts the frosting on the cake. It says, this poses two very interesting questions. How do planetary orbits become destabilized in such an old, mature system? And could such a collision happen in our own solar system? Now, look, Mr. Astronomer, Mr. Professional Astronomers. Of course, I've taken a lot of heat on the internet and other places throughout my professional career for making claims that exactly this type of scenario could happen. My work shows specifically how destabilizing orbits can occur and how electrical conditions come into the solar system. But these astronomers are so cloistered, so bound by their ridiculous idea that gravity is the sole force of glue, so to speak, in the solar system, and with this ridiculous concept that the solar system formed all at one time and somehow has been stable for billions of years and nothing has happened. Now they observe this in another solar system, but as I said, there is ample evidence within our own solar system to show that all kinds of things are going on all the time. New captured objects coming in. NASA announced a couple years ago that probably at least a dozen of Saturn's moons are known to have been captured. That's the only way they could have gotten into the orbits they're in today. So remember that the Japanese scientists, astronomers, about a year ago made a claim that they were hunting for a thing called Planet X. And they said that perturbations of the current planets indicate that such an object must exist. Remember that back in the 1980s, NASA funded a program that was carried out with the Naval Research Astronomical Observatory in Washington, D.C., headed by a guy named Harrington, which was specifically looking for a Planet X-type object related to our solar system that was perturbing the orbits of Uranus and Neptune, to be specific, pulling them down out of their orbit so it could only be explained by an object, a very large object, that was down below our solar system, down in that region where Harrington, in fact, was looking for this Planet X object throughout the late 1980s and into the early 1990s. So at any rate, I think it's just humorous, but let's take a little deeper look at this. On first reading, you think these guys are so out of it, they have no idea what's going on in the world around them, but let's look a little deeper. What's really happening here? Is the standard astronomical community finally trying to break the ice and pretending like they're just stumbling across this and making this discovery and they can now start talking about it as part of standard astronomical theory, weaving it in, and then they can, of course, make all the other discoveries later. But this is the icebreaker. This gives astronomers the so-called right to now start talking about collisions, catastrophic collisions in solar system as an integral part of standard astronomical theory. Do you see what's really going on here? It's ludicrous to see this happening, but of course, they're doing it as if they're making this discovery, like, oh gee, we made this discovery, it's in a solar system over there, it's in a star system over there with planets that must have collided and created this dust cloud, and therefore now we can start talking about objects colliding and destroying each other within stable solar systems. So you see, this is really a ploy, and of course it's released through Reuters, one of the standard news media agencies, to get it out to the public. Anyway, there's some subtleties here, but I want you to understand that it apparently was very important for these scientists and the scientific community at this time to release this article in this manner to kind of take over authority, so to speak, of the topic of collisions in the solar system, of catastrophes of the in the solar system. Look at what it says here. The massive collision would have wiped out everything in a matter of minutes, the ultimate extinction event. Gee, never heard of Velikovsky. Never heard of Jim McCanny. Anyway, it's just pretty ridiculous. And then the question, could such a collision happen in our own solar system? How do planetary orbits become destabilized in such an old, mature system? Gee, boys, people have already worked out the details on this, and so you're way behind the curve, not ahead of the curve. Anyway, on to the next topic here. Just a quick commentary on the bailout, and of course you've heard about this. The blogs are ripe with angry people. This is the biggest ripoff of on the American public. And the Bush legacy will be one of burying the United States in so much debt that it can never get out. And, of course, who does this debt go to? The European bankers. The congressmen are traitors. They should all be arrested and put in prison for life. But now let's examine this. Of course, you can read about this on the Internet. You can hear about this on the news, other radio shows. But the point that I want to refer to on this show, something I have yet to hear anyplace else, and so that's why I'm covering it here, is that this is an economic and a physical enslavement because they are taking away people's property on a national scale, turning over the titles, so to speak, to private corporations and to the banks. The European banks, who are supposedly funding this, but they're funding it with absolutely phony money, with interest also tacked onto this. So this is an enslavement of biblical proportions, where an entire country, all of a sudden, overnight, is becoming enslaved in debt. Debt that can never be paid off, that could never possibly be paid off, and is owed to some fictitious bank who has created this money out of thin air. So let's jump back maybe 2,000-3,000 years, and you see that the texts that came out of that, for example, the Colburn, which I've talked about and is part of the title of my second book, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection. And by the way, as I've always said, beware of that Colburn that's on the Internet. It's a phony copy. It has a big orange ball on the cover. That's the biggest disinformation plant on the planet. But at any rate, the real Colburn, and I have information on my webpage where to get the real Colburn. Many people have. It's very specific that interest cannot be charged, the way they're doing it today. The compound interest was totally made illegal in ancient times. And this is in the Old Testament. There are laws in the ancient texts and writings and the Old Testament, etc., preventing interest. And there's a reason for this, because they knew the people, the same people that are doing it now, are the same people that did it back then, pulled it on the Israelites, and they just love to do this. And one of the key factors in being able to pull this repeatedly throughout history is to take over the education of the youth. And of course, that was done in the early 1900s when the Rockefellers invested and made public education a requirement. But they did something when they created public education in the United States. They watered down and took away the real meaning of the Constitution. Now, our forefathers created this country to eliminate personal taxes, meaning it was illegal to tax personal work. Your work and labors were your own, and what you gained from those personal labors could not be taxed according to the Constitution. So these same bankers, the ones that have basically gotten in, taken over public education, and that's why so many people are so stupid in this country, simply because of public education. They're taught just enough reading, writing, arithmetic, and they're just taught basically enough to live at a semi-functional level. And so the end result is what we see today. People simply have no clue that this, everything that's happening today with this bailout, the $1 trillion in debt which is being labeled, being burdened onto the general public, all of this is totally illegal. Congress does not have the right to borrow money and put you into debt. The corporations that are being bailed out are the ones that should be paying for the welfare of the country, and they're being bailed out. The people who in these corporations should all be in prison, but their buddies in Washington are giving them trillions of dollars. There's no accounting for any of this, of course. How did these companies get to this way? There's no oversight that has that should have occurred. The Congress turned their backs, and they're all a bunch of crooks and criminals. All of them should be arrested and put in prison for life. And as one person recently said, just a common guy that I talked to, just an average hardworking person, he said, you should put a fence completely around Washington and just make it a big prison because everybody in it is a crook. So at any rate, the point is, this is the repetition of incidents that happened in ancient times. The same techniques were used, and they seem to be able to use the goodwill of Israelites who are very hardworking, who built this country, built it up to where it is, in all their hard labors, and to trick them into turning it all over to credit with interest. So at any rate, once again, the key to this is taking away education and replacing it with what we see today, public education. Just a quick note on the big super collider. The first time they used it, it broke, and it's going to be down for 2 months. So it's already broken. But what's interesting is allegedly it's already proven the Big Bang Theory, which just, you know, the science that is going on today is so ridiculous. I call it the Tier 2 BS science. And the Big Bang is just one of them. So I'll be talking about just a little bit about that in a minute. I don't want to belabor it too much. But I could go on and do hours and hours and hours of contradiction, of scientific contradictions with the Big Bang Theory. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense at all. I'll just give an example or two tonight, any one of which would clearly disprove it and to the common man on the street. But the big collider, every time you hear its name, in association with it, you hear the term Big Bang. So that's another case. It's like when they send out a comet probe and they say, this is expected to prove the dirty snowball comet model. That's before they ever get there, take a picture, or make a single reading. And, of course, the scientists all on the teams all believe that, and all of their publications are based on that. So when they get out and see a comet and it has no ice on it, they still call it a dirty snowball. It's just that hot, black NASA ice, you know, that different kind of ice that's in outer space, according to NASA. But at any rate, it's the same idea. Nonsensical, gee whiz science that's pawned off to the public as real science. Okay, so I'm going to go now into the main science topics. As I said, weather modification. I'll talk a little bit about the Big Bang, some of the ridiculous aspects of that. And then the third topic, electric trains, planes, and automobiles. So first, a note on weather modification. And I've done quite a few shows recently as guest, and the question that seems to come up from the public the most is, how could you possibly control something like a hurricane? And it just doesn't seem to click with the public that, and of course, it's a hard thing for people to imagine. So what I've done is I've developed some analogies that I use to show people how this is done. But basically, if you know in any type of endeavor in science or in physical situations in physics, if you know trigger mechanisms, you can release a tremendous amount of energy without expending a lot of energy. And one example I used is if you took a match and you had a huge pile of wood, how could that little match destroy that entire huge pile of wood? And the answer, of course, is that if you get this wood started on fire, then it will burn itself up. But you just need that little spark, that little match, and that's enough to burn down an entire forest. So it's a similar situation. If you can trigger the energy source that typically would drive a hurricane, then you can ignite a hurricane. You can control that hurricane. So let me give the specific example of how hurricane formation works. And once again, that's why it's so important to have ridiculous tier two garbage science out there, so the public is so stupid they would never understand how these storms can be manipulated and tracked and pushed around or dragged around to cause the damage they're causing. In the case of hurricanes, they are not driven by warm water. They are not, their energy source is not warm water, as you will hear like on the Weather Channel or weather.com. Those outlets for false information on weather are very important. That's why the government funds them. They want the public stupid. They don't want the public to understand the real science behind them. So they get a couple guys in suits and a woman to stand up there, and they sound pretty authoritative when they give, they have the nice big screen, they're on TV. Gee, they must know what they're talking about, right? But at any rate, the real cause of hurricanes is the electrical energy coming down from the ionosphere. And they attach to the cloud systems, and that's where the energy source is that drives the hurricane. Now, you can enhance that electrical current by shining a laser beam down the path to the top of the clouds on a cloud system that's coming off Africa, going out into the Pacific, or you can do this any place on the planet. And you can, therefore, if a hurricane begins to form, or even if you have a cloud system where the hurricane is not forming, you can create a hurricane by inducing the electrical path. And what the laser beam does, it's not the power in the laser beam that creates the storm. It simply ionizes a path down to the ocean level between the ionosphere, that's the upper layer, charged layer of the atmosphere, and the ocean, and it starts that electrical current passing. And real storms have that happen automatically, but you need exaggerated, like solar storms or electrical alignments of the planets. You need something from outside the planet to kick it off and sustain it where that energy is coming in from outside. To do it artificially, you simply shine the laser beam. What that does is ionize the air path, causing a nice electrical path, so you can induce a hurricane where normally there would not be one. You can increase the energy of a hurricane. And you can then, by moving the laser beam off to one side of the eye of the hurricane, you can make the hurricane go in that direction. So this is how it's done. It is managed by people. Now you might say, well, okay, the military, if they had these, wouldn't some board operator notice this? And the real situation with this equipment, even if you have a board operator, you look at the way the military systems are built, the command centers, etc., they all have bypasses in them, so someone in another control room can override what a control operator is actually looking at. And they've been doing this since back in the early days of the Cold War. And the reason they did it is because they think that, say there was a nuclear war at some point, some board operator may say, well, you know, at this point, I'm not going to push this button because I know my country's going to be destroyed and I'm going to destroy that country over there. So they have to have bypass systems in the board operator so that if any of the board operators don't do their job, they can be bypassed. So all of the systems, the control systems for satellites, laser satellites, all of these have bypass systems to bypass the operator. So, in fact, a board operator could be sitting there looking at his satellite or whatever he's supposed to be controlling, and the screen he's looking at and his control system looks like he's in control, but really someone in a different control room is actually manipulating the satellite, creating the hurricane, etc. So this is how these systems work. So you have to understand how all of this is put in place so that someone could be manipulating hurricanes using the laser satellites, and the board operators that typically would control those satellites wouldn't even know about it. The same thing happened during 9-1-1 when Cheney was in the command center, was able to shut down our own Air Force that never responded, while four planes were attacking buildings in this country, our Air Force for hours and hours was shut down because someone had that bypass system. At any rate, that's just an example. But back to weather modification, there are many tools. A lot of people, when I'm on radio shows, they always ask about HAARP. HAARP is an old technology. It's still used. It's bigger and more powerful than ever. But the people who are playing with the atmosphere, so to speak, have many, many, many tools at their disposal. HAARP is just one of them, and as I said, it's relatively old technology. So the whole issue with HAARP, sure, there's HAARP, but it's just one of many technologies, and it's relatively old, and it's not the one being used to control hurricanes. And then after that, you have to understand, well, why are they controlling storms? What's the reason? And typically, you have to wait till the storms are finished to see in retrospect what the damage was. Why were they doing this, like with the four hurricanes, Faye, Gustav, Hanna, and Ike? They all hit Cuba. They all hit Cuba. So that was the main purpose, and then they all did other damaging effects. And of course, Ike hit the Galveston area. It's still not clear why that area was chosen, but it would have been too obvious to send it up to New Orleans. I know they still want to clear out New Orleans because a lot of people are still living there. The so-called, what I call, ethnic cleansing using weather modification. But at any rate, I just wanted to give a little bit of a review of weather modification. On to the next topic. As I said, I would talk about the Big Bang. And let's look at what the universe should look like if there were a Big Bang. As we build bigger and bigger telescopes, looking farther and farther out into outer space, a good example is the telescope just brought online a little while ago. About a year ago. And they looked into a region about the size of a dime held at arm's length. So if you held a dime out at arm's length, that amount of area of the sky, that area of the sky that would be about that big, previously the largest telescope looked there and just saw a little bit of fuzz. They thought there might be a couple stars in the distant galaxy that might be in that little patch of sky. Then they tuned in with the bigger, more powerful telescope and found thousands, hundreds of thousands of galaxies. And so all of a sudden, what seemed to be almost an empty region of space turns out to be filled with thousands, hundreds of thousands of galaxies. And now it becomes obvious that if you could go to one of those galaxies and continued to look in that direction out as far as that new big telescope could see, you would for sure see more and more galaxies. This is pretty much in all directions. So no matter what direction you look from Earth, from our solar system, you would see galaxies. The most distant objects that you could see with your telescope, you would see hundreds, thousands of galaxies in all directions. Now, astronomers claim that those galaxies are at the edge of the universe or near the location where the Big Bang. You always hearing them say, oh, this is a galaxy that existed 500 million years after the Big Bang or something like that. You're constantly hearing these amazing numbers of galaxies 500 billion light years ago. Well, now, what would the universe look like if, in fact, we were looking back in time at the very original shape of the universe after an alleged Big Bang? And here's the answer. The universe would look something like a cornucopia, something like the Horn of Plenty. It looks like a very narrow end, and it kind of branches out, spirals out, kind of like a mountain goat horn. That's another example, or a spiral shell. There's some seashells that look kind of like that also. But a cornucopia is that horn of plenty with the fruit coming out the end, so to speak. And that's what the universe would look like, because as you look farther and farther out, and allegedly closer to the time of the Big Bang, all of that material would have to kind of coalesce or come from one given spot. In fact, if you got close enough and you could look far enough, you would actually see the beginning single point of the Big Bang, and that would be in a certain direction in outer space, and all of the galaxies that are at this point, they believe it was about 13 to 14 billion years ago. So all of the galaxies at 13 billion light years away would be in one spot in the sky and converging on that original source point of the alleged Big Bang. Now, if you see what I mean. And all of the other parts of the sky would not have any galaxies that are that distant, because they would all be converging on this place where the Big Bang occurred. But that's not what you see. No matter where you point your telescope in outer space, no matter what direction, no matter how far out you look, you always see more galaxies farther and farther out. And so there is no single point where the Big Bang occurred. Now, that is a major contradiction that anybody can understand. This basically tells you that the Big Bang simply is fable. It doesn't exist. It never happened. And the universe, as far as we can tell, extends in all directions equally. It's equally balanced. It's uniform. And, of course, there are areas that have more galaxies than others. But in general, no matter which way you look, there are galaxies. And they do not converge on a single point in space that would represent the point of the Big Bang. So no matter how far out you look, there is no convergent point. And that would be absolute proof enough for any grade school student to understand that there was not a Big Bang. Yet, they'll build a super collider and talk about the Big Bang. They'll talk about black holes. The basis for the Big Bang theory is really incorrect. And that was originated by a guy named Hubble back in the early 1900s. And it was based on the realization that redshifted light coming from stars or galaxies, if it's redshifted, would indicate that those objects are moving away. And so no matter where Hubble looked with his telescope, he had one of the most powerful telescopes of the day, no matter which direction he looked, and he was one of the first to identify galaxies as star systems that were distant, separated from our own solar system and galaxy, that these were independent islands in space of star systems, billions of stars in each galaxy. And he realized that all of these galaxies and the other objects, as they started to discover them, produced a redshift. And so, therefore, it seemed to indicate that they were all moving away from us or expanding. So we lived in an expanding universe. The only problem is they didn't understand that there was another source of redshift, that all of their measurements of redshifts had nothing to do, or some of them had a little bit, but the majority of redshift was actually caused by another source, that the redshift was an internal property of these objects and was not related to the movement of the object, because there was another source of redshift. And of course, my research identified that source of redshift, and it's theoretically described. It's called the induced electric dipole redshift. It's verifiable in the laboratory. And in fact, there's no reason at all anymore to talk about the Big Bang. The Big Bang should be the deadest theory on the planet. It should be something maybe given a passing mention in old textbooks and maybe talked about simply because it existed at one time, but in one sentence explained that astronomers once thought this, but it's wrong. But it's taught at the highest level of in the universities. Students go to get PhDs and are taught this totally incorrect science, and then go on to pursue lifelong careers pursuing totally incorrect science. It's truly amazing to watch, truly amazing to see all of this amazing expense and equipment that is being dedicated to totally incorrect physics, and then to watch the news media just follow this like a bull with a ring in his nose and spout this off like reciting nursery rhymes when there's absolutely no shred of truth in it at all. But as I said before, this is tier two science. This is what's pawned off to the public, and there's a great expense monetarily to support these basically incorrect ideas. In fact, I talk with friends now and then, and we talk about the absolute incorrect concepts that are being passed around today. I mentioned one earlier that they continue to talk about the Mayan calendar and talk about 2012 and the December 21st and the end of the world predicted by the Mayan calendar. As I said, the Mayan calendar never will have anything to do with the solar or lunar calendar. It was based on the cycles of Venus. But people repeat it like a nursery rhyme. And that's one of the, I guess the hallmark of Americans. If you say something 10 times, Americans will repeat it like it's the gospel truth. The global warming. How many newspaper articles, magazine articles, how much congressional funding has been given out for a principle that is totally, patently false? Just truly amazing. But I think that'll be the hallmark of the United States of America throughout history, that if you could repeat something 10 times, Americans would believe it and repeat it and continue to repeat it, continue to support it, continue to send money to it, and that could go on and on. At any rate, I just wanted to, in talking about the Big Bang, there's a great deal of nonsensical, what I call gee-whiz science, and the more complicated, convoluted, and when we were in school, if we had a lecture or if we went to a scientific meeting and it was basically very poorly given, we would call it basically a snow, like a blizzard. We had a couple expressions. It would, like a blizzard, in other words, a snowstorm of information. It was like white snow flurrying all around the room that made no sense. There were professors who were excellent, would give very good, concise, logical definitions and follow through, and the physics would make a lot of sense. But there were other ones that would give what we would call a blizzard lecture. And not pretty much I was very lucky to have excellent physics teachers. But now and then you would find one someplace, sometimes a on TV or on the radio or other places, that would give basically a blizzard explanation, a lot of gee whiz terms, a lot of fanfare, but not much content, and certainly not a lot that made sense. And typically would, if they were ever asked any detailed questions, they would give a blizzard type of answer. So at any rate, there's a lot of so-called gee whiz science out there today that has to be created because of the Big Bang Theory to continue the so-called cover-up of real science. And what I've discovered in my study of science is that things are pretty simple. They're complicated, nature is very subtle, but when it gets right down to it, nature is very simple. So don't complicate it, don't overcomplicate it. Just keep to the simple principles, and you will find pretty much all of the time that you are on track in explaining what nature's mysteries really are. On to the third topic, electric trains, planes, and automobiles. And I want to concentrate a little bit on electric planes. We're all familiar with trains, magnetically levitated trains, or electrically powered trams and trains, typically to move the population, people carrier, so to speak. A lot of people don't realize that a diesel locomotive, really the diesel engine in a typical diesel train, powered train, what it is really doing is driving an electric generator, which then powers the train. So a lot of people don't really understand that the diesel is really driving a generator, which is driving an electric motor. But at any rate, trains are, I would say, for the most part, electric in nature. Automobiles, of course, there's a lot of activity today with hybrid cars. There are pure electric cars out there, really high-end, like the Tesla car. So I'm not going to go into those too much, but what is the future of electric airplanes? Well, the future is very simple. The engines are there. The electric motors are there. There are experimental electric airplanes that can fly just about uninterrupted because they have solar panels on their wings. There's one that's very long. I think it's about 30 or 40 feet wingspan. It's basically a flying wing that has solar panels on the wings and basically can fly uninterrupted as long as the sunlight is shining on the wings. And there's all types of innovative configurations of the solar panels. They have solar panels that can create electricity on both sides. So the lower side of the wing is also absorbing light and creating electricity. So, but that type of a plane is very light and is not going to carry people around. So the next question, what can we do as far as batteries are concerned that will be light enough, provide enough power for sustained flight? And it's going to be quite a long time till we get to the point where they will sustain flight equivalent to the energy in, let's say, jet fuel. But then let's look at the possibility, what is most jet fuel expended on? And the average jet, for example, let's take an airliner, 200-300 people aboard, that's flying at 30 to 35,000 feet on a long distance trip. The majority of the fuel, probably 99% of the fuel, is expended in pushing through the atmosphere. So if you can eliminate the need for pushing through the atmosphere and get into a suborbital flight, your fuel requirement just went down by a tremendous amount. So the trick with an electrically powered aircraft is to find a way to propel it with electricity and get it out of the lower atmosphere. And of course, I do have designs that do that. These are electromagnetic propulsion systems. You can also have propeller type systems. But as I said earlier in the show, it's quite interesting to see the remote control small model airplanes and helicopters that are capable of flying for very long periods of time on batteries. So I remember when I was a kid, I used to try and take my model airplanes that I would build, you know, with the balsa wood and covering it with paper. And I tried to put, remember I had a multi-engine aircraft, a small model, and I tried to put electric motors in the wings and then use like D-cell batteries, which were the only type of batteries available at that time. And I remember you could hardly get this plane to move and taxi, let alone take off. Well, the technology is such now that the batteries are more efficient, they're lighter, they carry much more energy for the weight, and the motors are far more efficient. Very efficient motors, very powerful motors. And so there have been improvements both in the motors and in the storage capacity of batteries. So you now have electric planes and small model remote control helicopters, which are very versatile. They can fly for a very long period of time. And this technology could be advanced to larger aircraft to carry people. And as I said, by using innovation to get out of the lower atmosphere, get up into the thinner atmosphere where you have less wind resistance, you could fly farther. In fact, I've been a proponent for a long time of suborbital flight, something that is taking shape. It's going to happen probably within the next 10 years, I would say. You will more than likely see suborbital flight. In fact, passenger planes would, with the price of gasoline and airplane fuel these days, it would behoove airlines to start looking into suborbital flight. It costs far less in terms of fuel, it's far more efficient, and you get the passengers there much quicker. But of course, if you can do that, then you can probably start going into outer space. And that is frowned upon by the people who want to control outer space and keep the public away from outer space. So at any rate, there is a future for electric propulsion. And of course, true fusion batteries could be a source of energy for long-term sustained electric-powered flights, both in the atmosphere and out of the atmosphere. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.